Finland and Turkey are scheduled to meet over the weekend to discuss Ankara's objections to the Nordic countries' NATO bid.
Now, I think the good news here is that Erdogan is talking to the Finnish government. A couple of days ago, he said, "Don't bother to come to Ankara. I don't want to talk to you." So he's shown a little bit more flexibility there.
Plus, Kyiv reports that Russian forces have reduced a city in eastern Ukraine to rubble.
The business city is turned into ruins. So the industrial city has been completely destroyed and there are no surviving buildings at all.
And later in the program, the story of exiled Russian artists living in Finland. Today is Friday, May 20th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Miller.
Yarın aynı şekilde.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said that he will speak to Finnish officials on Saturday while maintaining his opposition to Finland's and Sweden's NATO membership bids due to their history of hosting members of groups who Ankara deems to be terrorists. Finland on Thursday said it will go through the issues Turkey has raised and provide, quote, clear answers. Jamie Shea is a former NATO official as well as an associate fellow in the International Security Program at the Chatham House in London. And I began our conversation with him by asking about Erdogan's objections and where NATO may be flexible.
Well, this is, of course, something not for NATO, the organization, to sort out, but for the NATO leadership, because this is something where just this week the NATO ambassadors were blocked and they made it clear that they didn't see any point in meeting again as ambassadors until their heads of state and foreign ministers had been in touch with President Erdogan and worked out some kind of arrangement. Now, I think the good news here is that Erdogan is talking to the Finnish government. A couple of days ago, he said, "Don't bother to come to Ankara. I don't want to talk to you." So he's shown a little bit more flexibility there. And also, those are US and NATO diplomats who have met recently with the Turkish foreign minister, Cavusoglu, and other Turkish officials report that their approach is slightly more pragmatic and slightly more flexible than that of President Erdogan, who, of course, is also playing to his Turkish public opinion at home. And, of course, NATO knows that President Erdogan has done this kind of thing in the past in trying to block, for example, back in 2010, the appointment of Anders Fogh Rasmussen of Denmark as the new NATO Secretary General. Erdogan eventually backed down. And same story in 2019 when Turkey tried to block some NATO military planning for the defense of the Baltic states, but after a few weeks backed down there as well. So I expect that this is all very untidy and not at all elegant, but there will be some kind of arrangement very soon.
So, Jamie, as these officials are meeting this weekend, as someone who's very familiar with NATO, what are you looking for?
Well, I think, first of all, Finland and Sweden could say that as they come into NATO, they would be happy to resume arms sales to Turkey, which henceforth will, of course, be one of their NATO allies. That I think, would please Erdogan. I think the US administration will say that it will push ahead to seek approval from Congress to be able to sell Turkey F-16s, which is what Erdogan is seeking, and to upgrade the existing Turkish F-16 fleet. Turkey has paid money for this. And of course, it's important that Biden is able to get Congress to go along with this. I think the other thing is that Finland and Sweden will probably make some noises about their solidarity with Turkey when it comes to fighting international terrorism. But whether they will do what Erdogan wants them to do, which is to actually extradite some Kurdish people living in Sweden in particular, some of whom, of course, have taken on Swedish nationality over the years, that's a different story. So I think enough will be done so that Erdogan can climb down with a face-saving formula, but which will not mean that Sweden and Finland are seen to be humiliated by going against their own concept of human rights.
Jamie Shea is an associate fellow with the Chatham House think tank in London. Thank you. The United States Senate passed a $40 billion bill on Thursday that provides humanitarian and military assistance to Ukraine. In a written statement, U.S. President Joe Biden said, quote, I applaud the Congress for sending a clear bipartisan message to the world that the people of the United States stand together with the brave people of Ukraine as they defend their democracy and freedom, end quote. After a week of delay, the vote means President Biden will be able to sign the bill into law just as billions in aid passed earlier this year runs out. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has that story.
Aid to Ukraine arriving just in time. The nearly $14 billion in military and humanitarian assistance passed by the U.S. Congress in March has almost run out. This massive new package passed with bipartisan support in a vote of 86 to 11. Democratic Majority Leader Chuck Schumer.
We, Americans, all of us, Democrat and Republican, cannot afford to stick our heads in the sand while Vladimir Putin continues his vicious belligerence against the Ukrainian people, while he fires at civilian hospitals and targets and kills children and innocent people. But when Republicans and a significant number oppose this package, that is precisely the signal we're sending to enemies abroad.
All 11 of those senators were Republicans, including Rand Paul, who delayed the vote by a week by arguing for greater U.S. government oversight of the aid. Some are also concerned the U.S. has sent too much money to Ukraine while Americans face rising costs of living. But the Senate's top Republican said the cost of not acting is too high. Republican Minority Leader Senator Mitch McConnell.
But aid for Ukraine goes far beyond charity. The future of America's security and core strategic interests will be shaped by the outcome of this fight. Anyone concerned about the cost of supporting a Ukrainian victory should consider the much larger cost should Ukraine lose.
The U.S. also authorized $100 million in military equipment transfers.
There will be 18 155mm howitzers, 18 tactical vehicles to tow those howitzers, and 18 artillery tubes, basically is our equivalent of a battalion, an artillery battalion, and 3 AN-TPQ-36 counter-artillery radars.
The effort to target Russian oligarchs who benefit from Russian President Vladimir Putin's decision to invade Ukraine will also receive an additional $100 million in funding. $900 million will go to aid Ukrainian refugees and $4.4 billion to address a food supply crisis. Secretary of State Antony Blinken.
The food supply for millions of Ukrainians and millions more around the world has quite literally been held hostage by the Russian military.
That aid is expected to be dispersed quickly once the bill receives Biden's signature. Since the February 24th Russian invasion, the U.S. has sent nearly $54 billion in aid to Ukraine. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
British military experts say with Mariupol largely under Russia's control, Moscow is now likely to redeploy its troops. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma is up next.
The defense ministry says now with the number of defenders left holed up in the Mariupol steel factory dwindling, Russian commanders will be coming under increasing pressure to reallocate troops to bolster their offensive in eastern Ukraine. Moscow says more than 1,700 defenders at the steel plant have surrendered since Monday, the likely final stage in the nearly three-month siege of the now pulverized port city. In Mariupol, an unknown number of defenders remain in the plant, which is the last bastion of Ukrainian resistance in the city. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Russian forces reportedly continue pounding cities in eastern Ukraine, with Kyiv saying that the city of Rybizhne has been reduced to rubble. Earlier, I caught up with reporter Anna Chernikova in the Ukrainian capital to learn more.
So the most heavy fightings continue in the Donetsk and Luhansk regions, and especially Luhansk regions, this couple of days. Today we received official comment from the head of the Luhansk Regional Military Administration, Serhii Haidai, who told us that Russian forces in general, according to the estimated data for the moment, so Russian forces destroyed more than 11,000 houses in the Lugansk region, and more than 8,000 of those are private estates. And in particularly, Russian forces had a very important goal to occupy the city of Rubizhne, so they needed this point to be captured as this operational point. And basically, what we can see from the satellites that Rubizhne city is turned into ruins. So the industrial city has been completely destroyed, and there are no surviving buildings at all. Many houses even cannot be restored. And also what we can see are the cemeteries just in the yards of those buildings.
And in the time that we have left, I want to turn our attention to a video that was released on Thursday evening by the commander of the Azov battalion. What can you share with us, since this video hasn't been independently verified yet?
The commanders remain Azovstal plant. Today, the commander of the Azov regiment, which is under the National Guard of Ukraine, Denis Prokopenko, announced in the video appeal that after 86 days of the protection of Mariupol, the defenders have received the order to save lives and health of the servicemen and to stop fighting. He highlighted three main conditions for that, so the evacuation of the civilians, evacuation of the heavily wounded soldiers, which should be exchanged after the stabilization of their condition, and the evacuation of the dead soldiers, so the dead bodies.
And we'll have official updates on our website, voanews.com/flashpoint, as details emerge. Anna Chernikova is reporting for us from Kyiv, Ukraine. Anna, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. Western allies have imposed crushing sanctions on individuals close to President Vladimir Putin and parts of Russia's economy. The moves were a response to Russia's unprovoked and ongoing war in Ukraine, but a major part of Russia's economy is doing fine. Better than fine, according to one analyst. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has more.
Despite sanctions squeezing much of Russia's economy, cash still flows through the country's rich energy sector. This comes after a much smaller drop in Russian oil exports than anticipated. Ben Cahill is a senior fellow of energy security and the climate change program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He spoke with VOA on Zoom.
Many people expected that we'd see 2 to 3 million barrels a day of oil production capacity lost in the first month, including the International Energy Agency, a lot of consultants. That didn't happen. It's probably been less than 1 million barrels a day. And so now I think we're at a point where EU officials are saying, what's next? How can we ratchet up the economic pressure on Russia? Because what we've done so far isn't working.
Western sanctions have led to retaliatory actions by Moscow, further accelerating calls in Europe for alternative energy sources. In France, farmers mash together crops and agricultural waste before fermenting the mix, producing biofuel to potentially power hundreds or thousands of nearby homes. In Portugal, a floating array of 12,000 solar panels the size of 4 football fields is that country's latest effort to ditch fossil fuels. Meanwhile, Germany's vice chancellor recently accused Russia of using fossil fuels as a weapon. Yet the price of oil keeps going up. That means even by selling less oil, Russia is bringing in more money. Once again, Ben Cahill of CSIS.
It's a bit of a paradox. The more momentum there is to actually, take this oil offline, the bigger the price impact will be for the countries that import Russian energy. And that is economic pain that EU policymakers might be willing to tolerate. But you can't attempt to take the world's largest oil and products exporter out of the market without having an economic impact. And it's a global impact.
Further straining global supply chains, truckers and the trucks that deliver almost everything we buy are facing spikes in the cost of diesel fuel. Yet one part of the EU's upcoming sanctions proposal, says Cahill, could really hurt Russia.
If you cut off shipping insurance, that means that any company with a tanker can't get insurance to transport stuff from Russia. And that's a big risk. What if that tanker sinks? What if it runs aground? What if there's some sort of environmental disaster if they have no insurance? So cutting off that tanker insurance is actually kind of an overlooked part of the EU sanctions package. That could actually have a big impact.
While Europe navigates choppy energy waters, Cahill says Russia has had some luck selling oil to India and China, but often at steep discounts around $30 per barrel below market value. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
Russia's Gazprom has informed Finland that it will halt flows of natural gas beginning Saturday morning. This is after the Finnish state-owned gas wholesaler refused to pay its Russian supplier in rubles. Gazprom Export has demanded that European countries pay for Russian gas supplies in rubles because of sanctions imposed over Moscow's invasion of Ukraine. Meanwhile, a spokesperson for the Czech utility CEZ said the company made its payment for Russian gas in euros, declining to provide further details. Several top U.S. officials have also made the dangerous voyage into Ukraine since the war began in February, raising the question, when will President Joe Biden make the trip himself? VOA's Anita Powell reports from the White House.
U.S. President Joe Biden has dispatched several high-level Americans to war-ravaged Ukraine in recent weeks. But the White House says that he has no firm plans to make the dangerous trip himself. It's not for lack of desire, says White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre.
He wants to visit Ukraine clearly in the future, but there's no plans to go at that at all at this time, I should say. He sent Secretary Blinken and Secretary Austin to Kiev to demonstrate our unwavering commitment to Ukraine. And the First Lady, as you all know, went for Mother's Day to send an important message that the American people stand with the people of Ukraine.
Biden first sent his two top cabinet officials, Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin, to the under-siege capital. While there, they announced a nominee to fill the shuttered U.S. embassy in Kyiv and pledged $713 million in military support. Then it was the First Lady's turn. She crossed into a border town and made an emotional appeal on Mother's Day, joining a fellow mother, Ukraine's First Lady.
I thought it was important to show the Ukrainian people that this war has to stop, and this war has been brutal, and that the people of the United States stand with the people of Ukraine.
And two U.S. congressional delegations have gone to Kyiv to show their support. But presidential visits to war zones have a higher bar, says presidential historian Jeremy Suri. They involve high risk and historically, he says, little payoff.
There's no evidence in any of the examples I can think of that a presidential visit actually made a difference in the outcome of the war. It is symbolic. It matters politically. But not visiting doesn't destroy your policymaking, just as visiting doesn't make your policy.
And he noted presidents have previously visited places where there is a U.S. military presence. Not here, which makes this extraordinarily risky for a man as high profile as the president. And he added, mortal danger isn't the only risk a president faces there.
So there is the infamous case of George W. Bush when giving a joint press conference with the Iraqi leader, an Iraqi journalist throwing a shoe at him. Many things can go wrong when you're outside of your own country, when you're in a war zone, and when even with all the checking that you do, you don't really know who the people are who are around the president. And that's particularly problematic when it's not American soldiers in Ukraine, as it was in most of the other cases we've talked about.
Suri notes that the perils of Ukraine mean that any Biden visit will be necessarily shrouded in secrecy until after the fact. And so, it may be some time before these two leaders are again face-to-face. Anita Powell, VOA News, the White House.
The Kremlin has attempted to tie the alleged perpetrator of a mass shooting in Buffalo, New York, to Mariupol's Azov fighters based on symbols. Polygraph.info explains why that's misleading and lacks context.
On May 14th, an 18-year-old white gunman drove to a grocery store in Buffalo, New York, then allegedly shot 13 people, killing 10. Authorities called it a hate crime. 11 of those shot were black. In an online manifesto, the alleged shooter used fascist and neo-Nazi rhetoric. The document bore an image of a black sun, a symbol of the far right. Russian state media outlet Sputnik seized on that fact with a headline that read, quote, Buffalo shooter's manifest has Nazi symbol previously used by Azov battalion. That is misleading. The Black Sun originated in Nazi Germany. White supremacists have used the symbol for decades, but it is not specific to the Azov Regiment. It's true that the regiment began in 2014 under far-right leadership, but Ukraine says it is now depoliticized and part of Ukraine's professional armed forces. The regiment defended the port city of Mariupol. Meantime, the alleged shooter's manifesto contains pro-Russian views. It calls for the death of the president of Turkey, a NATO member country, to, quote, remove a prime enemy of Russia, destabilizing and fracturing NATO. Russian President Vladimir Putin has cited US-led NATO expansion as a reason for attacking Ukraine. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has said his country rejects extremism.
Polygraph.info is a fact-checking website produced by the Voice of America. The website serves as a resource for verifying the increasing volume of disinformation and misinformation being distributed and shared globally. Amid a severe clampdown on political opposition in Russia following its invasion of Ukraine, thousands of people have fled the country, including many artists, whose work is often critical of President Vladimir Putin. Some of those artists are now in Finland, and Henry Ridgewell brings us this story to round us out.
Theater director Mikhail Dernenkov and actor Alexei Yudnikov are both long-standing enemies of the Kremlin. For decades, their performances parodied the Russian government and its leader, Vladimir Putin, testing the boundaries of expressive freedom under constant state surveillance. Following Russia's invasion of Ukraine, both men fled the country and have found temporary shelter at a haven run by the organization Artists at Risk in Helsinki, Finland.
Просто чтобы не быть...
Dernenkov told VOA, "We left the country simply so as not to be on the side that is waging war, so as not to cast our votes in this way. If I'm here, in Finland, that means I can speak, I must speak, and I must help the protest voices from Russia to be heard, because in Russia it is impossible." Anti-war protests in Russia have been brutally suppressed. A new law imposes jail terms of up to 15 years for spreading what the Kremlin calls fake news about the invasion. Dernenkov says the space for freedom of expression has all but disappeared. There is an unspoken law that exists now in Russian society, he says, whereby if you are a country at war and if you say something against it, you are selling out your country at the front line. And this will be punished instantly, severely, that very second. Ukrainian-born actor Alexei Yudnikov also fled Moscow following the invasion, leaving behind his family. I feel pain and personal guilt, he said. What could I alone change? I couldn't find any better option than just leave. It was spontaneous, an instinctive gesture to leave, but also to try again here in Finland, simply because here, outside of Russia, you can tell the truth. Yudnikov staged a protest outside the Russian pavilion at the recent Venice Biennale Art Festival in Italy. He says the invasion of Ukraine has unleashed a parallel war within Russia. The henchmen of this regime are trying to impose absolutely shamelessly this formula that Putin is Russia and that these things do not exist without each other. This is a war between reality and escape, a total escape from this reality. If you like, it is a war between something real and something fake. Dernenkov and Yudnikov are among the artists who have fled Russia since the invasion to preserve their freedom, but also to continue voicing their opposition. They don't know if or when they will return home. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, Helsinki.
And that's going to do it for us this week. Be sure to stay up to date with our continuing coverage on Ukraine, as well as news and events from around the world. You can do so 24 hours a day at voanews.com and on our social media platforms. Just follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Miller. Be well, be safe, and good night.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.